Okay, let's unpack this. The human mind, it's just an incredible complex machine, isn't it? Capable of amazing things, but also full of these surprising shortcuts, biases we often don't even realize are there.
That's right.
So today, we're diving deep into Daniel Kahneman's, well, seminal book, Thinking Fast and Slow, and really digging into its core idea, how we make decisions, using two very distinct ways of thinking. Sometimes they even seem to conflict.
Exactly. Kahneman makes this fundamental split between a rapid, intuitive way of thinking, calls it system one, and then a slower, much more deliberate system two.
Right.
And our deep dive today, well, it's going to reveal how these systems work together, how they complement each other, but also, and this is critical, how they can sometimes lead us completely astray. We're drawing on a really great Wikipedia overview and some other sources too to get right to the heart of it.
And our mission, like always, is to pull out the most important nuggets, the key takeaways from all of this material. And we'll give you those, moments, a shortcut, really, to being well-informed about how we judge things, how we make decisions. And there are definitely plenty of surprising facts along the way.
Absolutely.
So let's jump right in. The book's foundation, these two systems, can you break down system one for us? What is it exactly? What does it do?
Okay. System one, it's our brain's fast lane. It's automatic. It's running all the time, really frequent. It's also emotional, often relies on stereotypes, and it operates mostly unconsciously.
Like intuition, gut feeling.
Precisely. Think of it as your intuition working without needing much effort. So, examples, like when you instantly know one object is further away than another, or you hear a sudden sound and immediately know where it came from.
Okay.
It's how you finish a common phrase like war and,
Peace? Yeah, automatic.
right, or showing disgust at a horrible picture, solving simple math like 2 + 2, reading a big billboard you drive past.
Got
You don't
it.
even try, it just happens. Even driving on an empty road is mostly system one. Or if you're a chess grandmaster, making a really strong move almost instantly, understanding simple sentences. It's basically our mental autopilot.
That paints a really clear picture. Autopilot. Super efficient, I imagine, but that speed must come with some trade-offs, right? So what's the other side of the coin? How does System 2 contrast with this?
System two is, well, pretty much the opposite. It's slow, it's effortful, you use it way less often.
Boy.
This is our logical, calculating, conscious thinking.
The hard work department.
Exactly. So system two kicks in when you're, say, bracing for the start of a sprint or when you're deliberately scanning a crowd trying to find one specific person.
Okay, yeah, I can feel the effort just thinking about that.
Right. Or trying to recognize a sound you haven't heard before or consciously keeping up a faster walk than usual. It's what you use to figure out if something's appropriate to say or do in a social situation or counting how many times the letter appears on a page of text. Giving someone your phone number, you have to retrieve that consciously. Parking in a really tight space. Comparing two washing machines to figure out the best value. Validating some complex logical argument. Or, the classic example, multiplying two-digit numbers, like 17 times 24.
Definitely not autopilot.
No way! That all needs deliberate, focused mental energy from system two.
It's fascinating how our brain juggles these two. I mean, I can definitely think of times my gut feeling, my system one, was spot on, but other times, wow, it led me way off track. How does Kahneman describe how they interact? Are they like collaborators or are they fighting it out?
Well, that's really the core question Kahneman digs into. He shows how these two systems can actually give you different answers, even when they start with the exact same information. System one is always on, you see, constantly feeding us impressions, intuitions, feelings,
Okay.
while system two is sort of monitoring things in the background and it steps in when things get difficult, or when system one flags something unusual, or when you consciously decide to
So
focus.
system two is kind of lazy.
Kahneman actually uses that word laziness. System two often just defaults to system one's suggestions to save effort. He talks about coherence. System one loves to create a simple, consistent story, even if it has to ignore some inconvenient
Yeah.
facts. Our attention is this limited resource that system two desperately needs. Association is huge. System one links new stuff to things we already know. And crucially, we tend to jump to conclusions, often based on very little evidence. This is where Kahneman brings in that acronym, WYSCIDI.
WYSADI. What you see is all there is. That really sticks with you, doesn't it?
It
So
does.
basically, our quick thinking system one cooks up a plausible story from whatever bits of info are right in front of it, even if it's incomplete. And system two is often just too, Well, busy or lazy to question it properly.
That's a good way to put it.
Wow, that must have huge implications. I mean, think about things like law or market research.
Yeah.
Anywhere, human judgment is really critical.
Absolutely. The shortcuts themselves aren't necessarily bad, they're efficient, but they can lead to systematic, predictable errors in judgment.
Okay, this is where I think the big aha moments start happening for people listening. Because once you get how powerful and sometimes flawed System 1 is, it suddenly clicks why we fall into these mental traps. So, what are some of these common errors Kahneman identified?
Right, so Kahneman argues that as humans, we're generally not great at thinking statistically. Our intuition isn't built for it. And this is where heuristics come in.
Heuristics,
Yeah.
mental shortcuts, basically.
Exactly. System one uses them to quickly make sense of things, often by associating new information with existing patterns or easier questions, instead of doing the hard work of creating new patterns or analyzing statistics.
Yeah.
And these heuristics are what lead directly to cognitive biases.
Okay, lay some on us.
All right, first up, the anchoring effect. This is our tendency to get latched on to the first piece of information we hear, even if it's totally irrelevant.
Like a price negotiation.
That's a classic example. But Kahneman uses a really striking one about Gandhi's age. He asked people one of two questions first. Was Gandhi more or less than 114 years old when he died? Or was Gandhi more or less than 35 years old when he died?
Okay. Wildly different anchors.
Totally irrelevant anchors.
Yep.
But the group that got the high anchor, 114, guessed his age at death significantly higher than the group that got the low anchor, 35.
Wow.
And the really compelling part, people are often completely unaware that this irrelevant number just influenced their judgment.
So the takeaway is like, be super wary of the first number thrown out in any situation. Once you see the anchor, maybe it has less pull.
That's the idea. Awareness helps. Okay, next. The availability heuristic. This is where we judge how likely something is based purely on how easily examples come to mind.
Oh, like if you see lots of news reports about something, you assume it happens all the time.
Exactly. The underlying logic for System One is if I can think of it easily, it must be important or frequent. Think about, say, plane crashes versus car crashes. Plane crashes are rare, but very vivid and heavily reported. Car crashes are far more common, but less memorable. So people often overestimate the risk of flying compared to driving.
Right, because the dramatic images stick in your head.
Precisely. The ease of recall doesn't always match up with the actual statistics. It often just reflects vividness or media coverage.
Makes sense. What else?
Another really fascinating one is the conjunction fallacy. This is where System One trips up on probability by substituting an easier question, usually about representativeness or plausibility, for a harder statistical one.
Okay.
Kahneman's famous Linda problem illustrates this perfectly. He called it his best-known and most controversial experiment. Participants read a description of Linda. She's young, single, outspoken, smart, majored in philosophy, and was concerned with discrimination and social justice in college.
Okay, I have a picture of Linda in my head.
Right. Then they were asked, which is more probable? A, Linda is a bank teller. Or B, Linda is a bank teller and is active in the feminist movement.
Oh, hang on. My System 1 is definitely yelling B because it fits the description so much better.
Exactly. That's the intuition. And overwhelmingly, people chose B. But logically, statistically, that's impossible.
Why?
Because the group feminist bank tellers is entirely contained within the group bank tellers. There can't be more feminist bank tellers than bank tellers overall. So A has to be more probable.
Ah, I see. It's a logic trap.
It is.
Yeah.
System one substituted the probability question with the resemblance question. How much does Linda resemble a feminist bank teller instead of what's statistically more likely?
That is wild how easily our brain makes that switch. And this kind of flawed thinking, it links into what Kahneman calls a pervasive optimistic bias, doesn't it?
It certainly does. We tend to be overly optimistic about outcomes, especially ones involving ourselves. This fuels what he terms the illusion of control, this belief that we have way more control over events than we actually do.
Right. And that leads to the planning fallacy.
Exactly. The playing fallacy is our tendency to, well, overestimate the benefits and underestimate the costs and time involved when we plan things. We focus on the best case scenario.
Guilty as charged.
We all are. This bias often pushes individuals and organizations to take on really risky projects or admit to timelines that are just, frankly, unrealistic. He gives this fantastic concrete example from 2002 about American kitchen
Oh,
renovations.
yeah.
The average homeowner expected their remodel to cost around $18,658. the actual average cost, $38,769.
Ouch, more than double.
More than double. That's the planning fallacy in action combined with that optimistic bias.
That's a perfect real-world hit to the wallet. And this ties back to WISID, right? What you see is all there is. We focus on the nice new kitchen we can see in our mind's eye and kind of ignore all the potential problems we can't easily imagine.
Absolutely spot on. WISID is often lurking behind these errors. Kahneman argues our minds primarily deal with known knowns, the stuff we're aware of and have information on. We're much worse at considering known unknowns, things we know we don't know. Right. And we're almost completely blind to unknown unknowns, the things we don't even know we don't know, the unexpected stuff. WISID means we build our plans and confidence based only on that limited slice of knowns, failing to account for complexity and the massive role of chance or unforeseen events.
So the insight is you have to actively force yourself to think about what you don't know, what could go wrong.
Precisely. Deliberately seek out the unknowns and uncertainties. It's system two work.
Okay. What about the framing effect, how things are presented?
Ah, yes. Hugely important. The framing effect shows how the exact same information presented in a different context or with different wording can drastically change our decisions.
Like the glass half full or half empty idea.
Sort of, but with real consequences. Consider Kahneman's experiment about surgery. One group of people was told the surgery had a 90% survival rate. Another group was told the exact same surgery had a 10% mortality rate.
Identical outcomes.
Identical outcomes. But framing it in terms of survival significantly increased how many people said they'd opt for the surgery compared to framing it in terms of mortality.
Wow. So just swapping survival for mortality changes the choice, even though the risk is the same. That's a powerful reminder about language, isn't it? And how easily system one gets swayed.
It really is. And one more major bias to cover here. The sunk cost fallacy.
Ah, throwing good money after bad. I know this one.
We all do, unfortunately. It's that tendency to keep investing time, money, or effort into something, a project, a business, even a relationship that clearly isn't working out simply because we've already invested so much.
Right. You don't want to feel like the past effort was wasted.
Exactly. It's often driven by a desire to avoid the feeling of regret, or maybe to justify our past decisions to ourselves or others. Host, I bet you can think of a time you stayed watching a terrible movie way too long just because you'd already paid for the ticket.
Oh, absolutely. Guilty. Or worse, kept pouring energy into a work project I secretly knew was doomed just because I'd already put in so many hours. It's that feeling of admitting defeat feels almost physically painful sometimes. Cutting your losses is hard.
It really is. System one hates losses and regrets. But the key insight, the system two intervention, is to realize that past investments are sunk. They're gone. Your decision about future action should only be based on future expected costs and benefits.
Easier said than done, but crucial.
Yeah.
So, okay, all these biases, anchoring, availability, optimism, framing, sunk costs, they all seem to point towards a larger problem Kahneman discusses, our pervasive overconfidence. Why are we so stubbornly sure of ourselves, even when we know System 1 is pulling all these tricks on us?
Precisely. There's a whole section of the book focused on this, on the undue confidence we place in what we think we know. Kahneman suggests we consistently overestimate how much we actually understand about the world. And relatedly, we massively underestimate the role of random chance in events.
Right. Things make sense in hindsight, but predicting them is another story.
Exactly. He talks about the illusion of validity and the excessive certainty we feel in hindsight. Once something happens, it seems obvious, inevitable even. But before the fact, it was usually one of many possibilities. He credits Nassim Nicholas Taleb, author of The Black Swan, for really influencing his thinking here about our blindness to large-scale, unpredictable events.
Taleb, right.
So the big takeaway on confidence, cultivate some intellectual humility. Be aware of how much you don't know and have a healthy respect for randomness and uncertainty. That's key for better judgment.
That's a really crucial point, recognizing our own limits. So, okay, bringing this all together, what does it mean for how we actually make choices, especially economic ones? This leads us to Kahneman's Nobel Prize-winning work, doesn't it? Prospect theory?
Yes, exactly. Prospect theory was a huge breakthrough developed by Kahneman and Amos Tversky. It was designed specifically to explain the experimental results that traditional utility theory couldn't handle.
Utility theory being the old model of the purely rational economic actor.
Right. Utility theory assumes people make decisions logically to maximize their overall utility or happiness or wealth. But Kahneman and Tversky's experiments showed people consistently violate those assumptions because of these cognitive biases we've been talking about. Prospect theory provides a much more realistic, psychologically grounded model of actual human choice.
So what are the key findings?
Well, one of the absolute core findings is that people are loss averse. We feel the pain of a loss much more intensely than we feel the pleasure of an equivalent gain.
Losing $100 hurts more than finding $100 feels good.
Generally, yes. Significantly more for most people. This means we're often more motivated to act to avoid a loss than we are to achieve a gain.
Okay, that explains a lot.
Another huge insight is how we value changes in probability. It's not linear, like utility theory assumes.
Mm.
It depends heavily on our starting point, our reference point. For gains, we overweight small probabilities. The jump from 0% chance to, say, 10% chance feels huge, like buying a lottery ticket.
The possibility effect.
Right. And we also overweight certainty. The jump from 90% to 100% also feels huge, like eliminating the last bit of risk. But a jump in the middle, say from 45% to 55%, feels less significant, even though it's the same 10 percentage point increase.
Interesting.
And for losses, it flips. We become risk-seeking to avoid a certain loss, and we really value eliminating a risk entirely, getting it down to 0%. The key idea is that our decisions aren't based on absolute final states of wealth or well-being, but on the perceived gains and losses relative to that reference point. And again, losses loom larger than gains.
That really does flip the old rational actor model completely on its head. It feels much more human.
It is. It accounts for the psychology.
And speaking of how we experience things, towards the end of the book, Kahneman makes this even more profound distinction, maybe, between the experiencing self and the remembering self. Can you unpack that for us? It sounds fascinating.
It really is one of the most intriguing and maybe most personal parts of the book. Kahneman made this significant discovery. The part of us that creates memories and tells the story of our lives, the remembering self, operates very differently from the self that actually lives through experiences moment by moment, the experiencing self.
How so?
The remembering self, remarkably, doesn't really care about the duration of an experience, whether it's pleasant or unpleasant.
Wait, duration doesn't matter to your memory?
Not much, according to Kahneman's research. Instead, the remembering self judges an experience retrospectively based almost entirely on two things: the peak intensity, the best or worst moment, and how the experience ends. This is called the peak end rule.
Peak end. Wow. So a long, mildly pleasant vacation could be remembered less fondly than a short one with one amazing highlight and a happy ending.
Exactly. Or think about a painful medical procedure. The remembering self's verdict might be dominated by the worst moment of pain and how much pain there was right at the end, largely ignoring whether it lasted 5 minutes or 30 minutes.
That's counterintuitive.
It is. And the remembering self is the one that makes future decisions. It's the one that decides whether to repeat the vacation or the procedure. Kahneman even wrote, quite strikingly, "Odd as it may seem, I am my remembering self, and the experiencing self who does my living is like a stranger to me."
Whoa. That's heavy.
Yeah.
So how did he study this?
Well, he got into well-being research in the 90s, realizing that most happiness studies just ask people overall life satisfaction questions. He felt these relied too much on the remembering self and flawed memories.
Right. Subject to all those biases.
Exactly. So he proposed measuring experienced well-being instead. Sampling people's feelings moment to moment, maybe using pagers or apps, asking things like, are you enjoying what you're doing right now? Would you rather be doing something else?
Capturing the experiencing self.
Right. And then you could potentially sum up those moments over time. He'd use examples like, was Helen happy in March? Well, she was. If she spent most of her time doing things she wanted to continue, little time in situations she wanted to escape, and not too much time just feeling neutral. And he found, unsurprisingly perhaps, that these two measures, remembered satisfaction versus experienced well-being, often tell very different stories about happiness.
That's a really profound thought. It almost brings us back full circle to some earlier ideas, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Like the focusing illusion. We might overemphasize one big thing, getting married, buying a fancy car, when we think about our happiness.
Yes.
Because the remembering self focuses on that peak event, that salient thing. It's like WISIETI again, or substituting the hard question, how happy is my life overall, moment to moment, with the easier one, how do I feel about this big memorable event?
That's a perfect connection. The focusing illusion means we often get a distorted view of the actual impact of single circumstances on our overall experienced well-being. The remembering self crafts the narrative often around those peaks and easily recalled items.
So the insight here is, when you're judging your own life, your own happiness, ask yourself, am I evaluating the actual day-to-day experience, or am I just evaluating my memory of it, shaped by the peaks and the ending?
That's a very powerful self-reflection question, yes.
Wow. Okay, so this book, Thinking Fast and Slow, It's clearly had a massive impact. I mean, New York Times bestseller, sold millions, won major awards, even influenced fields way outside psychology, like baseball scouting, helping them make better judgments under uncertainty.
It has been incredibly influential, no doubt about it. But, you know, for a balanced perspective, it's important to mention it hasn't been completely untouched by the replication crisis that's affected psychology and other sciences.
Wow. What's the issue there?
Specifically, some of the studies cited in the book, particularly around priming effects discussed in Chapter 4, The Associative Machine, these are studies suggesting subtle cues can unconsciously influence behavior. Some of those have faced scrutiny. Later attempts to replicate them haven't always been successful. One analysis gave that chapter a pretty low replicability index, suggesting maybe those specific priming effects aren't as robust as initially thought.
Huh. So a book about the flaws in human judgment itself contained some findings based on potentially flawed or at least hard to replicate studies. That's kind of ironic, isn't it?
It is deeply ironic, yes.
What was Kahneman's own response to that?
Well, what's crucial here, and speaks volumes about his integrity, is his own candor. He publicly acknowledged this, stating quite frankly something like, "I place too much faith in underpowered studies." He admitted he might have been overly optimistic about the reliability of some of that early priming research he cited.
Owning the limitation.
Yes. But it's also really important to stress that this doesn't invalidate the entire framework of the book or the core concepts like system one and two, heuristics, biases like anchoring or loss aversion or prospect theory. Those remain incredibly robust and widely accepted insights. And you still have figures like Nicholas Taleb comparing the book's importance to Adam Smith or Freud.
Right. So some specific examples might be debated, but the core model of how our minds work, the fast and slow systems, the common biases, that stuff holds up.
Very much so. The book's central contributions continue to shape how we understand ourselves.
Well, what an incredible journey that was, really digging into the mind's fascinating fast and slow processes and all those biases that quietly, powerfully shape our reality. Understanding these things about human judgment just feels invaluable.
Absolutely. This deep dive, hopefully, has shed light not just on how we think, but maybe a little bit on why certain patterns, certain errors keep cropping up. We really hope it encourages you, the listener, to just notice that interplay between your own system one and system two more often, to recognize those mental shortcuts in your daily life.
Definitely. And, you know, reflecting on all this, it raises one last important question for you to maybe ponder. Given that really profound distinction between the experiencing self and the remembering self, how might consciously trying to identify which self is doing the talking, which self is making a judgment or evaluating an experience right now, how might that actually change your perception of happiness or regret, or even the choices you make in your own life going forward?